We can document this lie even further. And this is a very disturbing aspect of this lie. The president has also said Iraq is on the verge of having a nuclear weapons capability. You remember the words of Condoleezza Rice, "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud." Iraq is within months away of developing a nuclear weapons capability. Well, first of all, we heard from the International Atomic Energy Agency, the nuclear watchdog responsible for evaluating Iraq's nuclear capability, and said, "That's absurd. Iraq doesn't have a nuclear capability." But don't trust those UN inspectors. They're a bunch of Keystone cops. We can't trust them. No, trust the CIA. Because the CIA went to the United States Senate, to the Senate Oversight Committee for Intelligence and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and held special briefings 1 to 2 weeks before that big vote last October where Congress gave the president war powers authority. There are a lot of senators who are on the sidelines saying, "Hey, you haven't made a case yet. You haven't answered our questions." So the CIA showed up and gave him a briefing. And the briefing focused on nuclear weapons. That was the key issue. The Senate provided two key pieces of information that swayed the senators. I'll give you an example. Dianne Feinstein of California, staunch liberal, dead set against the war, came out of the briefing. She was on the Senate Intelligence Committee at that time. And she said, "I have seen compelling evidence that has fundamentally changed my mind. I now am convinced that Iraq is working for a nuclear weapon." So she voted for the war. All right, fair enough. Except we found out that the information that she was shown was a lie. She was shown information about Iraqi procurement of aluminum tubing that the CIA said could be used for enriching uranium through a centrifuge cascade system. Highly technologically advanced system that Iraq never really perfected, but the CIA said they have perfected it, and here's the tubes that they can be used. It doesn't matter that the Department of Energy's intelligence branch, that part of the intelligence community responsible for overseeing nuclear issues, said, "Hey, those aluminum tubes won't work. Got to spin up at 100,000 RPMs, the things will shatter. We think they're used for ballistic missile rocket motors." They were silenced. It was that part of the CIA that had bought into the ideology of confronting Saddam that said, "No, these are used for centrifuges." But centrifuges don't work unless you have uranium. So now the CIA came in and showed documents to the senators that showed that Iraq had procured 100 tons of high-quality uranium, yellowcake, high-quality uranium ore from an African country. 100 tons. Now, why does Iraq need 100 tons? And that was the thing that swayed the vote. The senators weren't convinced about the aluminum tubes. But no one could square why Iraq would be buying 100 tons of high-quality yellowcake, uranium. So the senators said there must be a nuclear weapons program. Problem is, those documents were forgeries. These documents were shared with the International Atomic Energy Agency, and in a matter of hours, they identified the errors in the documents and exposed them as forgeries. What's even worse is the CIA knew they were forgeries when they presented them to the senators. Our senators voted for war based upon deliberately misleading information. This isn't just dereliction of duty, ladies and gentlemen. This is high crimes and misdemeanors. Don't tell me that we're at war because of a threat Iraq poses to our national security that is derived from weapons of mass destruction. Don't tell me you're at war because of a threat that Iraq has in terms of their links with international terror. There were 19 hijackers on September 11th. How many were Iraqi? None. Yet 80% of the Americans believe there's a link between the Iraqi government and those who perpetrated the events of September 11th. Why? Because the White House started putting out a legend in the fall of 2001. The legend of Mohammed Atta, an Iraqi intelligence agent that met in Prague, Czechoslovakia. It had all the good stuff of a spy novel, covert meetings, etc. And, you know, the American media bought into it. The Wall Street Journal published articles. The right-wing media published articles. The TV had it all over the place. The New York Times even reported it. Until the CIA and the FBI came out and said, it never happened. But it was too late. The big lie had been told too many times. Now we're convinced that this link exists. Ladies and gentlemen, the link doesn't exist. There's no justification for this war. And yet we are at war now. American soldiers are dying. There was a press conference that was given today by three wounded military members. And I think we should draw a lesson from this. They told a couple stories. And then the media has come out and talked about other members who have perished. One was a Marine Corps Lance Corporal from Florida, 23 years of age. Prior to joining the Marine Corps, he worked in a retirement home, providing care to those in need. He was a well-loved individual. But after September 11th, he resigned. He wrote a letter to the community, and he said, "I have to resign because I am in a position to protect you. Our nation needs protection. We came under attack. And I am leaving you, but I am leaving you to join the Marines, and I want you to rest easy at night, knowing that I and others like me are out there over the horizon protecting you." 23 years old, he died in Nasiriyah on Sunday. A wounded Army sergeant was also wounded in the battle near Nasiriyah. He was talking about his wound and how it came about. He turned to the media and he said, "I have a message for those who are demonstrating against this war. You may be against the war, but please don't be against the servicemen. I joined the military to defend my country. And I was fighting in Iraq to defend the soldiers to my left and to my right." The man was wounded. He's going home. And suddenly war doesn't seem like a good thing to him anymore. He's been in for 12 years serving his country proudly, yet he's leaving the military so he can spend time with his family. There's something wrong about this war, ladies and gentlemen, where we take honorable men such as these two, such as the 250,000 others that have joined them, and we subject them to this horror, this death, this sorrow for a cause that lacks in justification. It's not just dereliction of duty of those whom we elected to higher office, those whom ordered this military to go to war. It's a collective failure of we, the people of the United States. If we are to call ourselves a democracy, then we have to adhere to the standards set forward and the requirements of being a democracy. We have to reinvest ourselves as citizens of this great country. Today, we no longer seem to function as citizens. We function instead as consumers, wrapped in a cocoon of comfort. As long as the government keeps us happy, keeps us well-fed, keeps us cared for, and pushes us towards the road to prosperity, we have disengaged from this thing we call democracy. We no longer function as a democracy. That is why we have failed collectively. That is why American heroes are dying in a war they should never be waging. We need to rectify this, and the time is now. Is it unpatriotic to stand up to this war while American heroes are dying in Iraq? No. If you disagree with this war, it is the most patriotic thing you can do. It is a dereliction of your duty as American citizens if you fail to do so. So let's have that debate. Let's have that discussion. Let's do our duty as citizens. Thank you very much. So let's exercise that aspect of democracy called accountability. It's time for you to hold me accountable for what I said through questions and answers, and I'll take any questions anybody has. Yes, sir.
You were quoted as saying in a news program on PBS Frontline when your weapons teams went to the Agricultural Ministry, I believe it was in 1995. And the Iraqis would not let you in. So you essentially parked out in the parking lot and called the Security Council. You heard nothing. Next day, you called them again. You said, "Security Council, we're here. We're outside of the Agricultural Ministry." Nothing. How can weapons inspections work? And how can we prevent a war if the international community can't even stand up and push forth through inspections?
Yep. No, first of all, it's 1992. The summer of 1992, we were in a sort of a stymie situation at that point in time where the Iraqis had submitted a declaration that we knew to be false, and we were investigating that, and we were trying to do a shortcut by doing an inspection to grab an archive of documents that the Iraqis were hiding from us. We had reason to believe that there was a substantial archive hidden in the Agricultural Ministry. So we had good intelligence, and we surrounded the building. And we had the total approval of the Security Council. We're doing what the Security Council said. And we surrounded the building, and we're getting ready to go in. The Iraqis stopped us. Then the Iraqis surrounded us. So we had this little stalemate. We kept telling the Iraqis, "Boy, you guys are in trouble now, because the Security Council has passed a resolution that says you have to give us immediate access, or else there will be serious consequences. Let us in, or else you're going to pay a price." And we called the Security Council. Next day, we didn't get a call back. And the Iraqis went, "We're waiting." Serious trouble. Waited another day. Not a problem. The Iraqis started getting cocky. They started having demonstrations coming out. Anti-American demonstrations, anti-inspector demonstrations. Security Council did nothing. The next day, they came out in even greater numbers, and we started getting egged and throwing rotten vegetables at us. The Security Council did nothing. A few days later, we have 10,000 demonstrators surrounding us, shaking our vehicles, and the Security Council did nothing. Then they came in with a guy with a skewer and tried to stab one of our inspectors, and we said, that's enough, and we left. And within a week, the documents were evacuated. So how can we be effective if the Security Council doesn't have the will? Let me tell you something. Inspections can only work if a couple conditions exist. A, Iraq must abide by its obligations and must fully cooperate with the weapons inspectors. B, the Security Council, in passing a law calling for the disarmament of Iraq, must be willing to enforce that law. A law that is not enforced is no law at all. And I have to tell you, during my 7 years' time as a weapons inspector, neither one of those conditions were met adequately. But there's a third factor, too. If we're going to hold Iraq accountable to the rule of law and send in inspectors to implement the rule of law, we must ensure that the inspection and the inspection process operates within the framework of the rule of law, which means that our job in Iraq must be that of disarmament, as mandated by the Council. And yet, when you have a member of the Security Council, the United States, a permanent member with veto capability, who not only drafted the resolution calling for Iraq's disarmament, but voted in favor of it and promoted this concept, when they have a policy of regime removal which deviates from international law. Regime removal is the primary policy objective of the United States since 1991. Disarmament, in the mindset of those who monitor Iraq policy, is only useful so far as it facilitates regime removal. Disarmament, Security Council resolutions, the inspection process, is only useful so long as it legitimizes the continuation of economic sanctions, which contain Saddam Hussein, which destabilize Saddam Hussein, and then use the unique access afforded by the inspectors through their entry into sensitive sites to gather intelligence about Saddam Hussein so you can eliminate Saddam Hussein. That corrupts the process. You see, the Iraqis can't trust the inspectors. So it's very difficult to sit here and condemn Iraq for obstructing the work of inspectors when the inspectors are a de facto extension of an American unilateral policy which deviates from the mandate of the Council. The Iraqis didn't respect the inspectors as being objective implementers of Security Council mandate. They viewed the inspectors as being a tool of the CIA, and you know what? They were right. So it's hard to sit here and talk about making this process work. To make this process work, you need the Iraqis to be fully cooperative. You need the Security Council to be serious about its resolutions. You know, we had a situation last fall where the pieces were falling into place. The Security Council passed a resolution, 1441, that said Iraq must adhere to its obligation to disarm. And it said there will be serious consequences if you don't. And then a member of the Security Council, the United States, started putting military forces into Kuwait saying this will be the serious consequence. And the end result was that Iraq allowed the inspectors back in. And unlike what happened with me, the Iraqis allowed these inspectors to go anywhere, anytime. There was no obstruction, none whatsoever. Iraq turned over the documents that were required of it. The system seemed to be working, but we had that little third issue problem. You see, the United States still had a policy of regime removal that took priority over disarmament. The United States corrupted the entire process. The bottom line is, no internationally mandated program of disarmament, whether it's in Iraq or elsewhere, will ever work unless those who make the law abide by the law. The United States is the equivalent of a corrupt cop who, in seeking a successful prosecution, plants evidence or does an illegal search and seizure. We corrupted the process. So did the Iraqis. But since we're the ones who are supposed to be operating at a higher standard, the failure falls squarely on our shoulders. I hope that answered your question.
Thank you for speaking truth to power. I want to build on your last point. I'm an elected representative here in Tompkins County, and I want to speak for probably many people in this audience who have indeed been trying to raise our voices in a democratic fashion. We've been protesting, we've been writing letters, we have been, you know, some of us are fasting even, to try to make a moral statement about how we believe this is illegal. I find your mind very strategic. Will you give us advice as to how strategically we can get this collective voice heard in our present government structure?
Wow, well, there's a tough one. I'm going to preface my comments by saying that when I'm talking about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction, even military issues, I feel pretty solidly. But if you take a look at my background as a conservative Republican, former Marine, it doesn't have peace activist or, you know, activist of any sort there. So I'm going to throw out some ideas, but please don't view me as the shell answer man. I don't have insight, but I will answer this from the perspective of a military man who is used to waging war and understands what the concept of a campaign is and the importance of sequencing events to achieve a synergy. So instead of waging war, let's wage peace. Okay, let's go after and figure out how we can stop this war. The first thing I would say is you need an objective. You need a strategic objective. You cannot protest against something and expect to succeed. You have to protest for something. So you need to define what it is you're for, what you're standing for, what you want to happen. Is it stopping the war, or is it reforming the government that got us into this war? I mean, you need to define which one you want to do. And then in defining that objective, you now can start breaking it apart. How do we do certain other sub-objectives? And then create timelines. And then you have to pick those resources. We call them in the military, you know, we have tools, we have weapons, we have battalions, we have intelligence gathering platforms. These are the tools of waging war. The people are your tools of waging peace. And each person is capable of doing certain things. They can operate within their sphere of capability. Some people are capable of doing civil disobedience. I think that's a very important aspect of standing up to unjust government. Some people are capable of demonstrations. Some people are capable of putting direct influence on elected representatives. All of us are capable of voting, which is an important thing. I find it disturbing that only in the last election, only 37% of eligible Americans voted. That means that, and it was a close election, 17% therefore voted Republican. So Bush has this great mandate from 17%. That's not a mandate. All it took was another 5% of Americans to get off their butt on November and go and pull the lever, and we'd have a completely different political... Well, that was in 2000. But even in 2000, you say he stole the election. If more people had come out to vote, we wouldn't have to worry about that, would we? If more Americans had gotten involved in the process, is this what I talk about? Citizenship. Are we going to be passive citizens? You know, there were a lot of passive citizens in Nazi Germany. There were a lot of passive citizens in the Soviet Union. This is America. To function as a democracy, we have to become active citizens, which means we need to participate in the process. Voting is a big thing. Get out the vote. What you have to do is have everybody wage their own battle. And if you sequence this battle, you achieve a synergy that will enable you to achieve your objective. Define your objective, define and allocate your resources, and wage peace. Get them to vote. Because in the end, I think stopping this war, it's too late. Changing the government that got us into this war, that's where we can make a difference. And if you're waging peace, understand that the decisive battle will be fought in November of 2004. You had better start shaping the battlefield now by getting a viable alternative to George W. Bush, if indeed you want him out of the office. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for coming to speak tonight. I appreciate your comments, and I have two questions for you. One is particularly related to the unique insight you have as a former member of the military, and in relation to what you spoke to about the serviceman who was injured, who said protest against the war and not against the people who are fighting it. And so I would appreciate your comments on how we can focus our criticism on the policymakers and not those who are unfortunate enough to have to enact that policy. The second question I have is more asking if you have any comments on the Project for a New American Century and the report they put out in 2000 and how that ties into this above and beyond weapons of mass destruction, regime change, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, that's two totally different things. So I'll address the Project for a New American Century first. By saying, without getting into huge detail, a lot of people say that 9/11 changed everything. That's sort of an excuse that the Republican Party throws out there in defending many of their policies. 9/11 changed everything. All 9/11 did is facilitate implementation of a policy that it had already been decided upon. This policy goes back before 2000. It actually dates back to 1992 when Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz. Dick Cheney was the Secretary of Defense at the time. Paul Wolfowitz was one of his Deputy Assistant Secretaries of Defense. Wolfowitz drafted this policy of unilateralism saying that we have to exploit the collapse of the former Soviet Union and the power vacuum that exists to assert American dominance so we never again have to go through a Cold War. That policy was rejected by President George Herbert Walker Bush as being sort of un-American. And he said, go back and redraft it. I won't accept this. But Wolfowitz didn't have a chance to redraft it because a guy named Bill Clinton won the presidency. Wolfowitz went into exile together with a lot of other people like Dick Cheney and other Republican neoconservatives. And they festered, and I use that term exactly that, festered in think tanks for 8 years of Clinton presidency. And they hated Bill Clinton. They hated what Bill Clinton stood for. And it made them even more determined to put forward this new vision. They started something called the Project for a New American Century. You see, they were looking forward to the new century and how America will dominate this century by exploiting the power vacuum. And Bill Clinton's policies, in their mind, reinforced their contention that American adherence to international law, American embracing of multilateralism only weakened America. It brought us down to the lowest common denominator. We wanted to be the single factor. So they drafted this policy. And the people that drafted it are quite influential. Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, Douglas Feith, John Bolton. I'm mentioning people that, if you should recognize, they occupy senior leadership positions in the Bush administration today. So the Bush administration's policies in regards to confronting Iraq and confronting all nations that we don't agree with were decided well before September 11th. September 11th was simply a facilitating event. In the firefighting business, we would say it's a facilitator with accelerator. You see, it's like pouring gasoline on fire. Because it plays upon fear and ignorance of the American people. I mean, we're being cruelly exploited. Those Americans who died on September 11th are being cruelly exploited by the Bush administration. September 11th changed everything, we're told. Nothing will be the same. We are under attack. Well, we were that day. How many terrorist attacks have taken place since then? But we don't have to worry about that now because we have a Department of Homeland Security, which is backed up with legislation called the Patriot Act. In fact, we're going to enhance the Patriot Act. But why do we need a Patriot Act? Because the Department of Homeland Security tells us we're afraid. You know, Dennis Miller has spoken eloquently about this. You know, the national mood ring, red, yellow, orange. I mean, we're always pink. We're always going to be afraid. We're always going to be under attack. Therefore, as citizens, we have to give the government the power to defend us. We may even have to turn over some of our unalienable rights, some of our individual civil liberties. Give it to the government because we're under attack. And it's not just on the domestic front. We're threatened from abroad. We were attacked by Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. But why is it on September 12th, Paul Wolfowitz was briefing the president that in order to defeat Al-Qaeda, we had to destroy Saddam Hussein? So now we're told in order to be secure, we have to go to war against Saddam. And after Saddam will be the rest of the axis of evil. It'll be any part of the world that we determine to be unstable. This is Orwellian, ladies and gentlemen. War is peace. It's unreal. So be very concerned about the American Project or the Project for a New American Century, because what it shows is that this ideology of global domination predates 9/11. Don't buy into the excuse that 9/11 changes everything. Now to your first part, which you're going to have to quickly remind me because I have a short attention span.
How it is that we can be more mindful in our criticism
of the
policies,
okay,
those who are unfortunate enough to enact them.
Well, are you an American? Okay. If you're an American, I think we're supportive of this thing called the Constitution. I mean, I think we can all agree that the Constitution defines who we are as a people. Gives us our ideals, our values, our standards. Those soldiers who are serving in the Gulf right now took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution. So therefore, we have to hold them to that oath. Now, the soldiers in enlisting have foregone certain unalienable rights. They give up some of their constitutional rights to become a soldier. You have to. War is a horrible thing. There's no time for a debate at the base of a hill when the sergeant says go. There's a machine gun up there. You can't go, sergeant, there's a machine gun up there. You got to go and take the machine gun out. And if you don't and you fail, they have to hold you accountable. War is a horrible thing. So these soldiers who are joining to defend the Constitution have given up their rights to join the military. So they're looking to we, the people of the United States, to stand up and ensure that the Constitution is adhered to when we task them with doing this horrible thing called war. So in opposing a war that is unjust, you are actually supporting the soldiers more than you can ever imagine. There is no contradiction between being against this war and being pro-soldier. And what I would say here for everybody in this room, especially those who are against this war, when the time comes for these brave men and women to come home, regardless of the outcome of this battle, be at the airport to greet them, shake their hand, welcome them back into this community, and embrace them, because they are true heroes who signed up to give their lives for you. It is not their fault that they are asked to make the sacrifice in an unjust cause. That is our duty. That is our obligation.
I don't mean to sound foreboding or anything, and excuse me, but if this administration were not in power right now, I wouldn't ask this question. What measures do you have in place to protect the unique information you possess, and what measures are in place to protect your life? Because I really think that's a legitimate question right now, especially with what you've explained to us about the CIA and what we all know about this administration and the lies they've been telling us, because that is a very serious question.
Okay, I'll treat it as a serious, believe me, I treat it as a serious question. I'm very concerned about my well-being right now. Not my physical well-being so much. I've got, a half a dozen ongoing FBI investigations against me right now for any number of things. I'm a Russian spy. I'm an Israeli spy. I'm a British spy, and I'm not making a joke. I'm a
yeah, I don't think
Iraqi
this is humorous
spy.
At all.
No,
at
I'm
all.
Just, I'm being serious. I'm an Iraqi spy. I am a pedophile. I mean, I'm a lot of things that I've been accused of. All of these charges are brought forward in a manner to attack my credibility so as to de-emphasize the information that I possess. So that's what's happening. It's not so much that I'm worried about my physical safety. The FBI agents who are constantly on my tail, and they in the summer of 2000, they actually were surrounding my house and following my wife and harassing my family. And I called up the head of the FBI down in New York City, the guy in the National Security Division, why are you doing this? If you got a problem with me, just come and talk to me. I'll fully cooperate. I'm not hiding anything, but leave my family alone. So every other month, I get a phone call from the FBI, and we meet. We sit down and we have a nice conversation. They want to know what's going on. I will say something that's funny. This is the FBI that's investigating me on some very serious crimes. And yet before each meeting, they unzip a bag and they bring out these books, the ones I've written. They say, could you autograph this to Special Agent Joe? Because he was a former Marine and he really supports you. And I end up signing about 6 or 7 books before they sit down with the business of interrogating me. But in speaking with them, I asked them some serious questions. I said, why the hell are you doing this? Are you trying to intimidate me? Because it ain't going to work. They said, no, we're ordered to do this.
Just like soldiers are ordered to fight.
That's right. They're ordered to do it. But what they told me, and this is very telling, they said, we took the same oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States that you took. And if we are ever instructed to violate your constitutional rights to freedom of speech, our badge goes on the table. And I believe them on that. So I don't think the FBI is out to kill me. I think the administration is out to kill my reputation, out to commit character assassination, because I do have information that is unassailable. No matter what you do in a Google search on me, you will never find anybody that can contradict what I say on a statement of fact. My message is unassailable. So instead of attacking the message, they attack the messenger. And they had a very successful attack back in January. There was a media feeding frenzy about some unsustained allegations pertaining to an arrest in 2001 that I am legally obligated not to speak about. And they know I can't talk about it. The FBI knows because 3 hours before the reporter called me asking me about this case, I finished 2.5 hours of meeting with my FBI buddies. They want to know what I was up to. They knew I was getting ready to go to Iraq with a 6-point peace plan that had been approved by the Iraqi government. The Iraqis were ready to commit to a plan that not only encompassed disarmament, but a plan that encompassed democratization. Saddam Hussein was going to commit to the United Nations coming in and supervising the creation of opposition parties so there could be a fair and open election monitored by the International Committee for the Parliament in 2 to 3 years' time. Saddam Hussein was going to commit to bringing the United Nations Rapporteur for Human Rights back to Iraq, including Amnesty International, to monitor Iraq's human rights record. Iraq was going to commit to a peace plan with Kuwait, Iran, and, very importantly, Israel, if Israel could resolve its problem with the Palestinians in a manner which the Palestinians approved of. Iraq was going to support and guarantee its supply of oil to the West, that it would not use oil as a weapon. This is a very important thing that the Iraqis are ready to commit to. It constituted regime change, a change in the nature of the regime. It was going to provide George W. Bush with a face-saving way to extricate himself from the corner he had painted himself into. The plan was approved by the Iraqi government. It was endorsed by a group of Nobel Peace Prize winners in governments in France and Europe. This plan had viability. Therefore, they had to destroy the author of the plan, the one who was going to deliver it to Iraq. And the press reports came out. And not only kept the plan from going to Iraq, it kept me off TV. The week before the frenzy, I was on TV 5 times a day, all the major networks. Not because I want to be on it. I'm not calling them up saying, please put me on. They were calling me. And the voice was effective. The voice was effective. So the voice was silenced. Since the frenzy, I haven't been on a single television network in the United States. I've been all over international media, but my voice was silenced in the United States. This is what I'm fearful of, not only for me, because trust me, I can get through this. I got the love of my family. I got the love of my friends. I got the support of my community. I know where I stand. I know where I'm going to be in 5 to 10 years. I'm not worried about it. I'm worried about you. Because, ladies and gentlemen, if they can do it to me, they can do it to every one of you. A gentleman before you asked, what can we do to become involved democratically? You have to take action. But what happens when your action is viewed as a threat to those powers that be? It can come down on you. And this is what we have to be careful of. Character assassination, the politics of hatred.
You've been listening to Scott Ritter, former Marine Corps officer and UN Chief Weapons Inspector. He spoke in Ithaca on March 27, 2003. Thanks to Rick Wood, Ken Ritter, and Jeff Kirby for that material.
I am an American. I have the right to remain silent. I wish to refuse that right. And if you refuse that right, then everything you say can and will be used against you. Well, I am a poet also, so that is what I want. In the mouths of poets, words are like actions. They define you. And if your words don't define you, then why are you talking? If you ain't trying to go forward, then why are you walking? You should sit down and shut up, and you have that right. But I'm a poet and an American, and my pencil sparks light with each word that I write, and I will stand there and fight to the dawn's early light. As the bombs burst in air, I'ma stand right there, and I will speak my mind. I am an American. I, truthfully, am the truth you never fully told and still don't tell, but I tell the truth of who you are because I am who you are. I am an American, and I tell the truth. I am old women in department stores built atop the consecrated bones of Crazy Horse. I sign credit card receipts like treaties. I don't intend to honor a legacy of a debt that can never be repaid. I am restitution for the sweet dreams that can't come to the children who die because, hush, little baby, don't say a word. And you can't say a word, cause we built a Sears atop your grave, so you can't talk about the blanket soaked with smallpox that the government gave. I am the dead Indian baby swaddled in smallpox who watched the chickens come home. I, Malcolm X, I am not here to condemn America. I am here to tell the truth. And if the truth condemns America, then she stands condemned. I am the so many bones of the so many men and women that fell to ocean bottoms like tracks of the underwater railroad that led the wrong way to freedom. I am all the blank walls standing tall, a middle passage memorial to the names we do not know. I am Japanese American family standing in U.S. internment camps, concentrating on blank walls, remembering Harriet Tubman and slow dancing with the ghosts of Cherokees in prison in Alcatraz before they admitted Alcatraz was a prison and they called it a reservation. I am all the people trapped inside the lies we don't admit to. I am all the people in prison inside the history that never happened. I am the skeletons in the closet of the people who died waiting for their truth to come out. I am the truth coming out. I am America. And if you say I'm wrong, if you say we are not our history, if there is nothing but our present, then we must re-examine our scriptures with an eye for historical context. Look at our Constitution with a mind to reaffirm, for we are not created equal until we say so. And no commandments are contractually binding. All rights are alienable again. And freedom, it isn't certain. It isn't certain, but this is. I am an American, and I pledge allegiance to no flag. And our states, they're not united. And to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, I say to you this, there can be no one nation under God unless that nation is the world. For God made the world and man made nations. And if God were to honor man-made nations, he would do so with this condition, that he honor them all equally the way he made them. So to pledge to one is to pledge against others, and to pledge against others is to pledge against God. And I am not ready to go to war with God. And despite the fact that I think war is wrong, I am an American, and I pledge to no flag, but to the people who made it, who waited, who saluted, who burned it, who hide behind it. I pledge to you, I pledge to see you clearly and love you dearly as mortals, as people, as flawed individuals who bring your flaws to my America and sometimes make mistakes. And when you do, John Ashcroft, and when you do, Mr. Bush, I will tell you, and I am a poet, so I will tell that ish well. You are wrong to go to war. You are wrong to ignore the homeless and exploit the poor. You are wrong to put money above life on this earth. You are wrong to judge people by how much they are worth. You are wrong to think you are entirely free if you want me to be silent because you don't agree. I am an American, and I will not be silent because you will be. I will not be silent because you want me to be. I will not be silent because you think it wrong to disagree with my country. You should read the Bill of Rights and understand it was my country's idea. I am an American, and I will not be silent. I will not be silent. I will not be silent. And you should use these words against me. And liberty and justice for all.
Los Angeles poet Steve Connell, mixed to music by Christopher Sprinkle. Thanks to Nathan Thompson and Dave Adelson for making that available. Official reasons for the US-UK attack on Iraq don't hold up, as Ritter just detailed. What are the actual motives and objectives that are not being given to the general public? The historical record has shown that states never, and I repeat never, send their militaries into the field for altruistic reasons, though such are often given, as they play well with the common people of every nation, who are far more decent than those who rule them. Jeffrey Hurd, an Australian writer, offered an economic perspective on the Iraq War. In an article published on the internet, he wrote, "It's not about oil or Iraq. It's about the U.S. and Europe going head-to-head on world economic dominance." Why was George Bush so hell-bent on war with Iraq? Why did his administration reject every positive Iraqi move? It all makes sense when you consider the economic implications for the USA of not going to war with Iraq. The war in Iraq is actually the U.S. and Europe going head-to-head on economic leadership of the world. America's Bush administration has been caught in outright lies, gross exaggerations, and incredible inaccuracies as it trotted out its litany of paper-thin excuses for making war on Iraq. Along with its two supporters, Britain and Australia, it shifted its ground and reversed its position with a barefaced contempt for its audience. It has manipulated information, deceived by commission and omission, and frantically bought UN votes with billion-dollar bribes. Faced with the failure of gaining UN Security Council support for invading Iraq, the USA invades without authorization. It acted in breach of the UN's very constitution to allegedly enforce UN resolutions. It is plain bizarre. Where does this desperation for war come from? There are many things driving President Bush and his administration to invade Iraq, unseat Saddam Hussein, and take over the country. But the biggest one is hidden and very, very simple. It's about the currency used to trade oil and, consequently, who will dominate the world economically in the foreseeable future, the USA or the European Union. Iraq is a European Union beachhead in that confrontation. America had a monopoly on the oil trade, with the U.S. dollar being the fiat currency. But Iraq broke ranks in 1999 and started to trade oil in the EU's euros and profited. America's takeover will hurl the EU and its euro back into the sea, and make America's position as the dominant economic power in the world all but impregnable. It's the biggest grab for world power in modern times. America's allies in the invasion, Britain and Australia, are betting America will win and that they will get some trickle-down benefits for jumping on the U.S. bandwagon. France and Germany are the spearhead of the European force. Russia would like to go European, but possibly can still be bought off. Presumably, China would like to see the Europeans build a share of international currency ownership at this point, while it continues to grow its international trading presence to the point where it, too, can share the leadership rewards. But despite the silence in the general media, a major world discussion is developing around this issue, particularly on the Internet. This debate is not about whether America would suffer from losing the U.S. dollar monopoly on oil trading. That is a given. Rather, it's about exactly how hard the USA would be hit. The smart money seems to be saying the impact would be in the range from severe to catastrophic. The USA could collapse economically. The key to it all is the fiat currency for trading oil. Under an OPEC agreement, all oil has been traded in U.S. dollars since 1971, after the dropping of the gold standard, which makes the U.S. dollar the de facto major international trading currency. If other nations have to hoard dollars to buy oil, then they want to use that hoard for other trading too. This fact gives America a huge trading advantage and helps make it the dominant economy in the world. As an economic bloc, the European Union is the only challenger to the USA's economic position, and it created the euro to challenge the dollar in international markets. However, the EU is not yet united behind the euro. There is a lot of jingoistic national politics involved, not least in Britain, and in any case, so long as nations throughout the world must hoard dollars to buy oil, the euro can only make very limited inroads into the dollar's dominance. In 1999, Iraq, with the world's second largest oil reserves, switched to trading its oil in euros. American analysts fell about laughing. Iraq had just made a mistake that was going to beggar the nation. But 2 years on, alarm bells were sounding. The euro was rising against the dollar. Iraq had given itself a huge economic free kick by switching. Iran started to think about switching too. Venezuela, the fourth largest oil producer, began looking at it and has been cutting out the dollar by bartering oil with several nations, including America's bete noir, Cuba. Russia is seeking to ramp up oil production with Europe, trading in euros, an obvious market. The greenback's grip on oil trading and consequently on world trade in general was under serious threat. If America did not stamp on this immediately, the economic brush fire could rapidly be fanned into a wildfire capable of consuming the U.S.'s economy and its dominance of world trade. So how does the U.S. get its dollar advantage? Imagine this. You are deep in debt, but every day you write checks for millions of dollars you don't have. Another luxury car, a holiday home at the beach, the world trip of a lifetime. Your checks should be worthless, but they keep on buying stuff because those checks you write never reach the bank. You have an agreement with the owners of one thing everyone wants, call it petrol gas, that they will accept only your checks as payment. This means everyone must hoard your checks so they can buy petrol gas. Since they have to keep a stock of your checks, they use them to buy other stuff too. You write a check to buy a TV, the TV shop owner swaps your check for petrol gas. That seller buys some vegetables at the fruit shop, and the fruiterer passes it on to buy bread. The baker buys some flour with it, and on it goes, round and round, but never back to the bank. You have a debt on your books, but so long as your check never reaches the bank, you don't have to pay. In effect, you have received your TV free. This is the position the USA has enjoyed for 30 years. It has been getting a free world trade ride for all that time. It has been receiving a huge subsidy from everyone else in the world. As its debt has been growing, it has printed more money, written more checks, to keep trading. No wonder it's an economic powerhouse. Then one day, one petrol seller says he's going to accept another person's checks. A couple of others think that might be a good idea. If this spreads, people are going to stop hoarding your checks and they will come flying home to the bank. And since you don't have enough in the bank to cover all the checks, very nasty stuff is going to hit the fan. But you are big, tough, and very aggressive. You don't scare the other guy who can write checks. He's pretty big, too. But given a legitimate excuse, you can beat the tripes out of the lone gas seller and scare him and his mates into submission. And that, in a nutshell, is what the USA is doing right now with Iraq. America was so eager to attack Iraq now because of the speed with which Eurofire could spread. If Iran, Venezuela, and Russia join Iraq and sell large quantity of oil for euros, the euro would have the leverage it needs to become a powerful force in general international trade. Other nations would have to start swapping some of their dollars for euros. The dollars the USA has printed, the checks it has written, would start to fly home, stripping away the illusion of value behind them. The USA's real economic condition is about as bad as it could be. It is the most debt-ridden nation on earth, owing about $12,000 for every single one of its 280 million men, women, and children. It's worse than the position of Indonesia when it imploded economically a few years ago, or more recently that of Argentina. Even if OPEC did not switch to euros wholesale, and that would make a very nice non-oil profit for the OPEC countries, including minimizing the various contrived debts America has forced on some of them, the U.S.'s difficulties would build. Even if only a small part of the oil trade went euro, it would do two things immediately. Increase the attractiveness to EU members of joining the eurozone, which in turn would make the euro stronger and make it more attractive to oil nations as a trading currency and to other nations as a general trading currency. Start the U.S. dollars flying home demanding value when there isn't enough in the bank to cover them. The markets would overreact as usual, and in no time the U.S. dollar's value would be spiraling down. America's response to the euro threat was predictable. It has come out fighting. It aims to achieve four primary things by going to war with Iraq. 1. Safeguard the American economy by returning Iraq to trading oil in U.S. dollars, so the greenback is once again the exclusive oil currency. Send a very clear message to any other oil producers just what will happen to them if they do not stay in the dollar circle. Iran has already received one message. Remember how puzzled you were that in the midst of moderation and secularization, Iran was named as a member of the Axis of Evil? 3. Place the second largest reserves of oil in the world under direct American control. 4. Provide a secular subject state where the U.S. can maintain a huge force, perhaps with nominal elements from allies such as Britain and Australia, to dominate the Middle East and its vital oil. This would enable the U.S. to avoid using what it sees as the unreliable Turkey, the politically impossible Israel, and surely the next state in its sights, Saudi Arabia, the birthplace of Al-Qaeda and a hotbed of anti-American sentiment. 5. Severe setback to the European Union and its euro, the only trading bloc and currency strong enough to attack the USA's dominance of world trade through the dollar. 6. Provide cover for the U.S. to run a covert operation to overturn the democratically elected government of Venezuela and replace it with an American-friendly, military-supported junta and put Venezuela's oil into American hands. Locking the world back into dollar oil trading would consolidate America's current position and make it all but impregnable as a dominant world power, economically and militarily. A splintered Europe, the U.S. is working hard to split Europe. Britain was easy, but the other Europeans have offered support in terms of U.N. votes. So its euro would suffer a serious setback and might take decades to recover. It's the boldest grab for absolute power the world has seen in modern times. America is hardly likely to allow the possible slaughter of a few hundred thousand Iraqis to stand between it and world domination. President Bush did promise to protect the American way of life. This is what he meant. And Venezuela. And while the world's attention is focused on Iraq, America is both openly and covertly supporting the coup of the rich in Venezuela, which grabbed power briefly in April last year before being intimidated by massive public displays of support by the poor for democratically elected President Chavez Frias. The coup leaders continue to use their control of the private media, much of industry, and the ear of the American government and its oily intimates to cause disruption and disturbance. Venezuela's state-owned oil resources would make rich pickings for American oil companies and provide the U.S. with an important oil source in its own backyard. Many writers have noted the contradiction between America's alleged desire to establish democracy in Iraq while at the same time actively undermining the democratically elected government in Venezuela. Above the line, America rushed to recognize the coup last April. More recently, President Bush has called for early elections, ignoring the fact that President Chavez Frias has won 3 elections and 2 referendums, and in any case, early elections would be unconstitutional. One element of the USA's covert action against Venezuela is the behavior of American transnational businesses, which have locked out employees in support of the national strike action. Imagine them doing that in the USA. There is no question that a covert operation is in process to overturn the legitimate Venezuelan government. Uruguayan Congressman Jose Nayardi made it public when he revealed that the Bush administration had asked for Uruguay's support for Venezuelan white-collar executives and trade union activists to, quote, break down levels of intransigence within the Chavez Frias administration, close quote. The process, he noted, was a shocking reminder of the CIA's 1973 intervention in Chile, which saw General Pinochet lead his military coup to take over President Allende's democratically elected government in a bloodbath. President Chavez Frias is desperately clinging to government, but with the might of the USA aligned with his opponents, how long can he last? Some have claimed that an American invasion of Iraq would cost so many billions of dollars that oil returns would never justify such an action. But when the invasion is placed in the context of the protection of the entire U.S. economy for now and into the future, the balance of the argument changes. Further, there are 3 other vital factors. First, America will be asking others to help pay for the war because it is protecting their interests. Japan and Saudi Arabia made serious contributions to the cost of the 1991 Gulf War. Second, in reality, war will cost the USA very little, or at least very little over and above normal expenditure. This war is already paid for. All the munitions and equipment have been bought and paid for. The USA would have to spend hardly a cent on new hardware to prosecute the war. The expenditure will come later when munitions and equipment have to be replaced after the war. But ammunitions, hardware, and so on are being replaced all the time. The contracts are out. Some contracts will simply be brought forward and some others will be ramped up a bit. But spread over a few years, the cost will not be great. And what is the real extra cost of an army at war? Compare it with maintaining the standing army around the world, running exercises, and so on. It is there, but it is a relatively small sum. Third, lots of the extra costs involved in the war are dollars spent outside America, not least in the purchase of fuel. Guess how America will pay for these? By printing dollars it's going to war to protect. The same happens when production begins to replace hardware components, minerals, etc., are bought in with dollars that go overseas and exploit America's trading advantage. The cost of war is not nearly as big as it is made out to be. The cost of not going to war would be horrendous for the USA, unless there were another way of protecting the greenback's world trade dominance. Why are Australia and Britain supporting America in its transparent Iraqi war ploy? Australia, of course, has significant U.S. dollar reserves and trades widely in dollars and extensively with America. A fall in the U.S. dollar would reduce Australia's debt, perhaps, but would do nothing for the Australian dollar's value against other currencies. John Howard, the Prime Minister, has long cherished the dream of a free trade agreement with the USA in the hope that Australia can jump on the back of the free ride America gets in trade through the dollar's position as the major trading medium. That would look much less attractive if the euro took over a significant part of the oil trade. Britain has yet to adopt the euro. If the U.S. takes over Iraq and blocks the euro's incursion into oil trading, Tony Blair will have given his French and German counterparts a bloody nose and gained more room to maneuver on the issue, perhaps years more room. Britain would be in a position to demand a better deal from its EU partners for entering the eurozone if the new currency could not make the huge value gains guaranteed by a significant role in world oil trading. It might even be in a position to withdraw from Europe and link with America against continental Europe. On the other hand, if the U.S. cannot maintain the oil trade dollar monopoly, the euro will rapidly go from strength to strength, and Britain could be left begging to be allowed into the club. Some of the reasons for opposition to the American plan are obvious. America is already the strongest nation on earth and dominates world trade through its dollar. If it had control of the Iraqi oil base and a base for its forces in the Middle East, it would not add to but would multiply its power base. The oil-producing nations, particularly the Arab ones, can see the writing on the wall and are quaking in their boots. France and Germany are the EU leaders with a vision of a resurgent united Europe taking its rightful place in the world and using its euro currency as a world trading reserve currency, and thus gaining some of the free ride the United States enjoys now. They are the ones who initiated the euro oil trade with Iraq. Russia is in deep economic trouble and knows it will get worse the day America starts exploiting its takeover of Afghanistan by running a pipeline southwards via Afghanistan from the giant southern Caspian oil fields. Currently, that oil is piped northwards, where Russia has control. Russia is in the process of ramping up oil production with the possibility of trading some of its euros and selling some to the U.S. itself. Russia already has enough problems with the fact that oil is traded in U.S. dollars. If the U.S. has control of Iraqi oil, it could distort the market to Russia's enormous disadvantage. In addition, Russia has interests in Iraqi oil. An American takeover could see them lost. Already on its knees, Russia could be beggared before a mile of the Afghanistan pipeline is laid. And I have been reading from an article by Jeffrey Hurd, a Melbourne, Australia writer on the environment, sustainability, and human rights, on the economic justifications of the war in Iraq. It's not about oil or Iraq. It's about the U.S. and Europe going head-to-head on world economic dominance. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us via our website, www.unwelcomeguests.org. Thanks for listening.